Welcome, Telecom Fraud Warriors. I'm Dan Baker, Research Director of Technology Research Institute and editor of Black Swan Telecom Journal. Wangiri is a Japanese term, and it's one of only a handful of words, such as samurai, typhoon, tsunami, and karaoke, that have become part of the English language. So I thought, why not use the Japanese samurai or warrior as a theme for this webinar? The music you're hearing is the opening soundtrack for Japan's 2020 Taiga Drama, an annual drama series that is broadcast across 50 episodes once a week, with each episode lasting about 40 minutes. Now that's a ton of movie production, more than 33 hours. And each of these annual epic dramas is focused around the life of a single person. Most often it's someone from Japan's feudal era, a samurai warrior, or a family member of an important historical figure. And this year's drama is about the life of a famous 16th century samurai general named Mitsuhide Akichi. Now the cast of the drama includes about 60 well-known Japanese actors and actresses, and of course hundreds of not so well-known actors and extras. And a huge amount of money is also spent on costumes, realistic sets, high quality photography throughout. And when they show samurai battle scenes, you sometimes see more horses being filmed than you'll ever see in a Western style movie from Hollywood. Okay, so why does Japan's TV network go through so much trouble and expense in these dramas to recreate history with seemingly little relevance to today's tech-driven lifestyle in cities like Tokyo and Osaka? Well, the answer, I think, is that reenacting history is part of NHK's commitment to preserving the best in Japan's culture. There are lessons to learn when a 21st century actor plays the role of a 16th century person. You learn about virtues that transcend history, loyalty, dedication, hard work, and you also learn about the corrupt and evil side of human nature. And now we can also ask a similar question in the telecom world. What's the value of spending a lot of money on fraud control? Can't that money be better spent buying more network equipment or more customer support staff? Well, I think the error in that thinking is to forget the all-important quality of service a telecom needs to deliver to its customers. Think of the long-term damage revenue share fraud and illegal robocalling has done to voice telecom's reputation in the marketplace. A considerable amount of trust has been lost. Fraud has shifted revenue away from the telecom voice channel as the consumer loses confidence and good operators exit the business. So you fraud managers and Wangiri warriors out there play a more vital role in maintaining the telecom business than you're given credit for. Okay, what's this seminar about? You're going to hear from four experts on fraud control. Each of them gives their own perspective on Wangiri, discusses strategies, and explains the kind of solutions they offer to service providers. What is Wangiri? It's quite simply one of the most effective traffic pumping frauds out there, along with international revenue share fraud. The most common Wangiri scheme, of course, is when a consumer victim gets a phone call and the call is interrupted after one ring and the phone user calls the number back as a courtesy. Unfortunately, the return call is sent to a high-rate international destination where there's no one on the other end of the line except an IVR machine. Now, we'll also talk about in this webinar a new variation of Wangiri where the fraudster's invitation to call is done through the web. Ultimately, then, the common thread for Wangiri is a callback fraud. Okay, our first speaker is Colin Yates of New Zealand. Colin once headed up the fraud management group at the Vodafone organization, the whole group across the world. And since retiring from that position, he's been very active as an independent consultant and fraud database provider, operating his own firm called Yates Fraud Consulting. How are you doing, Colin? And just as important, how is New Zealand, you know, weathering this coronavirus pandemic here?
Hi, Dan. We're doing well down here, thanks. We're doing a lot better than most countries with the virus. We're a bit fortunate here in that we're an isolated country in the middle of nowhere, and we were able to close our borders, and we've pretty much got it covered.
Colin, you're in a unique position to advise about traffic pumping fraud because you're tracking the International Premium Rate Numbers, or IPRNs. And these are the numbers that are advertised on public websites where the fraudsters select their numbers and coordinate their attacks with the number providers. Now, are there any particular regions of the world you're seeing where fraudsters are targeting WAN gear in particular?
There are, but I think the important message here is that WAN gear is an issue that can impact any country in the world. Within our IPRN database, we have 242 countries with numbers listed in that, so any one of those could host WAN gear calls.
I see.
The destinations used for WAN gear were previously always countries with high termination rates for international calls, but we're now seeing some of the destinations being advertised with much lower termination rates. Now, we know WAN gear calls are still happening, but we're not seeing so many cases reported currently, so it's difficult to keep track of what countries are currently being targeted. But from the few cases I'm seeing reported, I think the most popular continent currently for terminating WAN gear is still Africa.
Yeah, WAN gear is like a straightforward pumping of calls, but behind the scenes, there are different classes of the fraudsters who play a role in the scheme. Can you explain a little bit more about how they coordinate the fraud?
Yeah, WAN gear is relatively easy to set up. The fraudster just needs the tools or the infrastructure to set up a number of short WAN gear calls to thousands of numbers within an operator's numbering plan, along with the ability typically just spoof the calling CLI so that call appears to have originated from a particular number, and that'll coordinate with an international premium rate number or range with high termination rates through VIP or other services which are at very little or no cost to them at all. So it's a nice, cheap, easy fraud to establish for them. The fraudsters will be in possession of a range of numbers from an IPRN provider, and these numbers will correspond with the spoofed CLI that's been delivered to those receiving them the spoof. During the advice given to customers by the telecom providers not to return call, despite the advice given to customers, I'm advised that up to 10% of those receiving missed calls will return that call. Our database is an ideal tool to identify those IPRNs that have been called and allow them to be blocked.
10% is a high number. People are very courteous around the world. In fact, the name WAN gear comes from the Japanese, means one ring. But, you know, my wife is Japanese, so I know a little bit about this. I lived 3 years in Japan. And if you say giri to a Japanese person, they immediately think of an obligation to another person. So the giri maybe means ring, but also there's a connotation of the word that implies a double meaning. Now, a few years ago now, you've been researching these global distribution and the volume of these IPRN numbers as a way to learn about how the fraudsters are operating. Can you give us a refresh on what your research is telling you about the trends?
Sure. The biggest surprise that I'm getting now is just the huge increase in numbers being advertised.
I see.
Particularly over the past year. Now, I've looked at these numbers and done some studies about where they're distributed across the six continents of the world, and I've taken the numbers from 2019 and compared those to the numbers from April 2020. And the results are quite surprising. When in April 2019, we were able to find 464,000 IPRNs advertised across all the number providers we operate. By this last month, April 2020, that number had increased to 1.65 million. That's just over a 200% increase.
Wow.
Which is significant. Then also looking at the regions which have contributed mostly to that increase, the continent with the most numbers advertised is Africa, which we'd expect because there's more countries in the continent of Africa than any other continent. Africa now has 42% of all the numbers advertised. Europe has 23%, which is the second highest, and it was unusual for me, because Europe has never been known as a high fraud terminating destination.
Yeah.
I then looked at where the biggest increases, and the highest increase was South America. The numbers have increased by 300% for the 1 year. Now we've even got El Salvador up in the top 10 fraudless destination.
Interesting.
So South America, the one that has the lowest increase is the Pacific Islands, Oceania, which 4 or 5 years ago would have been up at number one. But
yeah,
a few reasons for that is, one, the operators have become more aware of the high-risk destinations and have been blocking those rangers, which have forced fraudsters to look for new destinations, and they've been able to apply a trade-off between the higher termination rates and the less time to detection.
Yeah.
Which gives them more profit.
Does Oceania include New Zealand? Does it include Australia?
Yes, Oceania includes New Zealand and Australia and all the Pacific Islands.
Okay. I guess the influence of Colin Yates in that territory has kind of calmed things down. Actually,
I'd like to think that, but I'm not sure that's a reason.
Actually, though, I do recall you telling me that you have done some work in places like Cook Islands and helping them, because over the years, people around the world, they would automatically cut them off phone calls to those countries because they thought it were fraud regions. And, you know, you've been, you know, out there pushing to correct that problem.
Yeah, that big impact on the communities in those small islands as well, particularly now with the coronavirus, where no travelling anymore between the islands, and the only way that the families in the Pacific can communicate is through their communications, telecom communications, and if the countries are blocked, then they're completely isolated, and that can cause some real problems for them.
Now, these IPRM numbers going up more than 200% is really something. What do you make of that?
The strategy we had some years ago, just simply blocking countries, no longer works, because the fraudsters go to one country and they can't complete a call into that destination, and they just simply move down the list to the next one until they find a country that isn't blocked or a range that's not blocked. This has surprised me, the quantity of new numbers that's being added. Up until a few months ago, we were adding 150 and 300,000 brand new numbers every month. Now, during April, we've seen this huge increase in numbers. We've had 1.6 million numbers we found advertised on the 20th when we, or 20th of April when we last did our update, but 54% of those numbers were brand new numbers we'd never seen before. During the whole of April, we had 1.48 million new numbers added, so they're numbers we've never seen before. And that's a huge increase on the 300,000 that we've been adding the months previously. So I assumed that all this huge influx of numbers would be in response to the current corona pandemic, and that they would see this as an opportunity to increase the fraud, but I'm not seeing any evidence of that. So,
interesting.
I'm still wondering why there was just this huge increase in numbers, particularly new numbers added over this period.
Interesting, yeah. Well, let's break away and talk about your IPRN database. PRISM is the name of it. So I want to understand where your IPRN database fits in, if you can explain that.
Yeah, my database, the IPRN database, is relatively simple in that we monitor all the providers of IPRN numbers, and twice a month we download all the numbers that they have advertised, put those into a managed database, and provide that to CSPs, or customer service providers, to use as hot lists, in some cases blocking lists, but mainly as hot lists to try and alert them to a fraud that's likely to happen. Now, the biggest difference between this database and other databases, such as the GSMA database, for example, these other databases are numbers that have been previously used for fraud, and been notified by the victim, and then added to that database. We mine all numbers that have been advertised, primarily, as we had with the 1.48 million this month, are numbers that have never been used before. So they'll be the ones most likely to be used. iConnect, their database has a lot more data than ours. They do use my database as a source for the IPRN numbers that they use. So they are a customer of mine. But they also have a whole lot of additional intelligence to their database around allocated numbers, unallocated numbers, etc., which are not in mine. Mine is just purely IPRN numbers.
Yeah. And you have how many customers do you have?
We have 70 users. We've added a few more this week, but we had 65 going into this year. We've added another 5 this year, so we now have 70. Apart from the PRISM database, we also have a second database, which is all the mobile station roaming numbers. We found that about a year ago that a lot of IPRN providers are advertising MSRNs, prepaid numbers, so they're actually hijacking the roaming calls. We have about 54,000 of those numbers in the database as well, so they can. We just wanted to make sure that they weren't included in any blocking list, because that could then impact a customer's ability to roam.
Okay, wonderful. That's a nice quick briefing. Now, I want to remind everyone who's listening that you can learn more about these IPRN databases, because I spent a long time with him to develop a Black Swan solution guide that we published together on this subject. The title of it is called The IPRN Database in Its Use in IRSF and WanGuri Fraud Control. You can download it for free from the Black Swan Telecom Journal. Now, one final subject I want to discuss with you, Colin, is your general advice to fraud fighters. I know for a number of years you've consulted with companies who are trying to come up to speed on fraud practices. And one of the great lessons you taught me about fraud control is that fraudsters like to choose weak operators as their victims.
Absolutely right, Dan. As an operator, you must accept that you will should always be concerned about when you're going to become a victim, not if, because you will become a victim sooner or later. And there's so much information available now from the various industry associations, peer groups, colleagues, etc., about the various fraud schemes that are likely to impact an operator, that even the new fraud manager should be prepared enough to repel them.
Yeah.
We've got a number of prison users who have come to us after that suffered a major fraud loss and have had pressure from their management to make sure it doesn't happen again. And the number of them that have said to us they wish now they'd come to us before they were a victim instead of after. You mentioned in one of your articles previously about predators of the Serengeti, and fraudsters dislike the predators of the Serengeti. And they'll recognise those who are not prepared or capable to repel an attack, and they'll strike. They're constantly looking for the weakest link. So if you're prepared to repel the attack, they'll simply move on and find another easier victim. Now, it's just important to remember that preparation and defence is the key. And if you're not prepared, then you will suffer some losses.
Yeah, it's a wonderful perspective, Colin. And I personally would like to thank you for the fine analysis and the content of the great interviews you've done with Black Swan over the years. They've educated me for sure, you know, being a layman in this business, been invaluable stuff. And I think that they're invaluable to general audience of fraud controllers around the world and analysts. And so I bid you well. One of these days I'd love to get down to New Zealand. I see the tourist pictures. It looks like a lovely place to live. All right, Colin. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Bye, Dave.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah.
Okay,
our next speaker is Igor Suzenya from LANK Telecom. LANK is a St. Petersburg-based international wholesaler. They are a mid-tier wholesaler who carries about 3 billion minutes of international voice traffic a year. Now, if any class of carrier feels the sting of traffic pumping fraud like WanGuri, it's certainly the international wholesalers. A wholesaler is considered responsible for all the partners it connects to. So when its retailer gets hit with fraud, the first accusing finger is pointed at the wholesaler. And this is why the wholesaler takes drastic steps to deliver fraud-free connections. It knows the price of poor fraud fighter diligence is too high. So whenever a wholesaler offers a fraud warning or recommends a fraud control measure, that's industry advice worth listening to. Now, integral to its business, LANK provides an FMS software solution for its customers, which discovers and blocks WanGuri. And the tool is flexible and customizable enough to allow the operators to react to a threat and take the type of action that they want. Separately, Igor is also going to talk about a new variation of WanGuri that LANK has recently discovered that they're calling WanGuri 2.0. But first things first, hope you're doing well, Igor. I'm curious if employees of LANK are working from home like in the U.S. and Europe, and has the coronavirus epidemic affected the international voice traffic you carry?
Hello, Dan. Nice talking to you. We work from home since mid-March. We're used to work from home or business travels occasionally, so we're ready to switch the format. As for international voice, we see decrease of roaming traffic because people travel less.
Okay, interesting. So what's your assessment, actually, of the international threat of WanGuri? Who's being hurt most by this fraud, and is the threat still growing?
The original Wrongdoer is one of the main concerns of retail operators especially. We see a lot of attention to it in anti-fraud work groups and when we talk to retail operators directly. Wrongdoer affects customer experience and their brand and harms voice business in general. As for the size of Wrongdoer, it's estimated at $1.8 billion every year, so it's a major threat. We see reports of Wrongdoer with more than 1 million calls per attack.
Okay. And, of course, being a wholesale provider, you have that unique vantage point in investigating all kinds of toll fraud, revenue share, Wrongdoer, and so forth. How do you exploit that middleman carrier position in traffic monitoring specifically for Wrongdoer fraud?
We are connected to hundreds of wholesale and retail operators, so we know what is going on globally. This position let us see large volumes of traffic in international markets, both inbound and outbound. So we see attacks in early stages and learn from cases in all parts of the world. Our system analyzes inbound and outbound traffic, and we discover Wrongdoer on the first inbound stage. If we take inbound traffic, our tool, fraud management system, discovers a Wrongdoer attack with no mistake. And the primary tool that it uses is machine learning. Often the ranges involved in Wrongdoer have good track records, so analytical work is the best tool that we have. Secondary, we have a comprehensive database of fraudulent numbers. This is how we discover Wrongdoer in inbound traffic. And after discovering, we do blocking in real time, very granular and precise, due to analytical work, so Wrongdoer doesn't reach end user. As for outbound traffic, the tool discovers calls to Wrongdoer numbers and allows blocking fraudulent ranges on operator side or just plain a warning IVR message that is saying, like, you're trying to call a risky number. If you would like to proceed, press 1.
Okay, so you've got the tools in place to detect and block it. Now, in a recent interview I had with your chief operating officer, there's a totally new variation of Wrongdoer that you guys have discovered, actually, and they're alerting the international community about, and you called it the Wrongdoer 2.0. Now, this variation of Wrongdoer, the fraudsters use a different method. The fraudster still makes money when the person calls a fake outbound phone number. However, there's no inbound phone call. It's rather unique. There's an invitation only online. So how does this fraud scheme work?
That is correct. There is no inbound call, so this attack is more tricky than original Wrongdoer. Instead of short call attempt, fraudsters use bots and scripts to fill up online call me back forms. They also use software to initiate delivery of one-time passwords by voice message. And as for destination of those calls, they use expensive destinations or hijack international routes.
Okay. Now, how did you discover this new kind of Wrongdoer fraud?
Well, it's an interesting story. Our system discovered patterns of calls that were typical for original Wrongdoer. These calls were done by enterprises. Not only those were call centers with live callers, but also one-time password delivery voice numbers. That didn't make sense at all. We knew it was a fraud, but it took some time to realize what exactly is going on. Right after we presented our findings last year, we received feedback from partners that saw the same patterns in their traffic, too.
I see. And is there a type of enterprise that's more vulnerable to these attacks than others, or what?
Well, the enterprises with a lot of international voice traffic, so we're talking about large call centers, global companies with worldwide presence, also mobile applications and online companies that deliver OTPs by voice message.
I see. So the enterprises basically, they're in the business of contacting international contacts anyway, and so it's a very natural thing for them to want to have sales leads and call those companies back. Now, how do you actually detect and block this Wrongdoer 2.0 in your systems?
Well, our fraud management system, it performs two tasks, it discovers, and the second task is blocking Wrongdoer 2.0. This tool is very flexible and customizable, letting to decide how to react to a threat and to an attack. Inbound attack cannot be discovered because it's going to online, so other tools should be used. With outbound traffic, though, a tool discovers calls to Wrongdoer numbers and allows either blocking ranges or before playing a warning IVR message that you're trying to call a risky number. Same thing with original one, Gary.
Okay.
And all our partners, current and future, are welcome to use it.
I see. Now, is there any specific advice you have for operators to think about as they try to combat this WAN-GIRI 2.0? Any best practices that they can follow?
Well, it's hard to give a general advice for WAN-GIRI, WAN-GIRI 2.0 because it very much depends on operator-user relation. It's a very individual situation, and operators must balance additional revenue and client relation.
So, in terms of the solutions themselves, what sort of FMS features should operators be looking at?
Well, we recommend using an advanced fraud management system and do your best to discover attacks as early as possible. We recommend using analytics and machine learning, monitoring your traffic very closely, keep your databases of dangerous numbers updated. That would be a very, very good practice to follow.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, Igor, for this briefing. I want to tell the listeners here that we're working on finishing up a Black Swan solution guide that will look at the details of some of Lank Telecom's solutions. So please look for that link to download the free white paper when it's available on the Black Swan homepage. Well, I look forward to speaking to you again soon, Igor. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
I'd now like to welcome John Haraburda of iConnective. John is Principal Solutions Engineer Director and normally does lots of world travel meeting customers and supporting iConnective's TrueNumber Protect database. TrueNumber Protect is a global allocated phone numbers database that lives in the cloud, and it's an authoritative industry source showing the active and inactive status of phone numbers around the world. And since the traffic pumping fraudsters deal mostly in phone numbers that are legally in use by any operator, the database is a great way to identify and block fraud. John, how are you? And how are you doing these days? I know you're doing less travel because of the coronavirus, but when you do travel, where do you like to go in the world?
Hey, hello, Dan. Thank you very much for having us. It's been an interesting little change. I tell you, I do miss the travel. I really enjoy visiting Brazil and South Africa. It's probably my two favorite places to go visit. So hopefully in the next couple months, we'll get back into the groove of things and be able to travel again.
Never been to South Africa, but love to go someday. Okay, now iConnective has clients at 50 large and mid-sized voice providers around the world. And you maintain this cloud database of allocated telephone numbers from every country around the world, and your clients access that constantly updated intelligence to fight the WAN-GIRI and other frauds. Now, can you explain, you know, why this phone number database is so useful, and how is it different from, let's say, a blacklist? You know, various associations offer those databases and blacklists for their members.
Yeah, great question, Dan. So basically, TrueNumber Protect is a numbering resource for any service provider to use to help manage their traffic and fraud. The idea is that this is a full listing of ranges that exist and don't exist throughout the world. The value of it is really the ability to implement this as a proactive functionality in the network so that as calls are being stood up and originated, you're able to mitigate that fraud risk immediately before that call leaves the network. So one of the differences between, let's say, a blacklist solution that we've seen many industry groups and consortiums share is the idea that these blacklists come from historical vision of fraud. So the operator who reports on this has to visualize the fraud, identify it, prove that it's fraud, block it on their network, then decide whether or not to report it to the central consortium or group to now share and distribute. So the issue that you see is that many times these blacklists are populated by a very few number of operators. Secondly, the timeline that it takes from when the fraud hit that operator's network to when they report it is quite a long period of time. And the other issue is that they don't report on things that they don't know. So if that operator has never seen a call trying to go to a certain country in the middle of the Pacific, they don't know whether to block that or not. Now, the value of True Number Protect is that all of these this information is already at your fingertips. So you have the ability of knowing the relative risk for fraud on a call the very first time that country code at NDC or national dialing code is used in your network. So this proactive nature is the real value that it brings to the service provider.
I see. And so, you know, in terms of the actual clients using this, you know, cloud database to block Wangiri fraud, I mean, what do they do? How does it operate?
Well, the Wangiri is a really interesting use case, right? So most of the fraud scenarios are they look for the call leaving from their consumer, calling out to these relative risky numbers. Well, with the Wangiri, what our customers are starting to do, they've implemented solutions looking at the inbound call attempt. So again, with the Wangiri, what usually happens is a fraudster calls a mass group of numbers. They will let it ring one or two times, and then they hang up. And the intention is to get that redial. So what the operators are doing now is in those call attempts, they're able to know that the calling party address is one of these unallocated or risky number for revenue share fraud. And they're able to prevent that call from ever getting to the consumer. So we have two real use cases for this. So we have an operator in Europe that had a substantial Wangiri hit. They were getting, it was several hundred thousand dollars a month of fraud. And after implementing our solution, they were able to mitigate that fraud greatly by enabling their switch to prevent that call ever getting to the consumer. We have another U.S. a major operator that's done the same thing. They notified us of this one specific fraud attack that was over 500,000 call attempts. None of those call attempts ever got to the consumer. So what the operators are doing are eliminating that nuisance for the consumer to give them that better feel and better customer experience. And this is how they're integrating True Number Protect into serving their consumer base.
So it seems like, you know, everybody should be getting one of these cloud databases, but you only have 50 clients. So is the price prohibitive for an average, your average operator out there, or what?
Well, it's not as cheap as free. And so one of the issues is that many customers use these blacklists, and they are happy to deal with that and react proactive and reactive management of fraud after that. What we've seen, though, is we've seen operators then get hit with these frauds, notice that they have this ability of doing proactive management, and they tip a threshold to say, wait a second, why are we reacting to fraud versus being proactive? And when they actually look at the solution, part of the way we present this with customers is actually doing a free analysis of their traffic. And we enable them to then see what the potential value would be. And that brings them to the return on investment discussion very quickly, where they notice that it's a 1, 2, 3 month return on investment just looking at the fraud use case. Well, one of the values of True Number Protect is there's other use cases besides just fraud prevention. So this can be used for general network routing, for both voice and messaging. It can be used for business analysis and data analysis for their traffic with CDR enrichment and the like. And each one of these use cases you add on adds even a shorter return on investment for the product. So I think once they hit that tipping point and see that they need something proactive versus reactive, that really generates the interest. And then these customers, once they do sign on, are here for a very long time.
One of the uses I think you said before was you can actually put the city and country of the phone call in on people's bills, because of that database, you have all that information in the database of all of these worldwide phone numbers and addresses.
Exactly. So that's just one way of integrating with the billing system. One of the newer trends is looking at artificial intelligence and data analytics. Well, if you can introduce data points on that analytics of what is the country, what is the city that call is going to, what is the operator that call is going to, What's the time zone for that call? And is it business hours on a weekday or weekend period or maybe a Friday in the Middle East? Well, you want to see that traffic differently, right? And you can use that additional data point as an analytics point for the artificial intelligence environments as well.
One of the issues that you have at a fraud department is the integration of all these fraud fighting tools. I mean, you got this database and they've got blacklists, they've got their own FMS systems and so forth. And so where do you put your fraud blocking rules becomes a question.
Yeah, great question, Dan. So the key is with True Number Protect is we offer this as a cloud environment. So we provide a tool that allows the customers to define how and where they're going to use this information in their network. So what we typically recommend is a multi-tiered strategy of looking at real-time routing tables, blocking numbers on the switch, interface with the revenue assurance system and or fraud system, and then integration into larger business and analytics. And the idea is that by layering it in these different environments, you're able to track the fraud and move it through the mitigation flow. So a great idea is, let's say you start with the fraud management system. You integrate this with your FMS. You enable your FMS to now create different rules based upon when this traffic is triggered by the iConnective True Number Protect dataset. Now, when those rules are seen, you're able to threshold them at a very, very low threshold level, right? Even a single call attempt. You can then use that to get a comfort level to now say, great, I'm comfortable with these types of ranges to be associated with active blocking on the network. And now you add that to your partition, your area that you're having in the cloud environment, supporting your real-time blocking. And then you roll this traffic through and mitigate back and forth, including exception processing is built in with the tool management system. And then the output of this environment creates an interface that's unique for each destination device. So your FMS environment, your business analytics, maybe your switch, all have different import file formats, and we can customize what we output to fit into each one of those levels. So this really aids the implementation and speeds up delivery. I can't remember if this was a customer last time we talked, but we had one customer that recently signed up. And they went from signing the contract, paying the bill, getting access to the data, and implementing it, and going live within a week.
Interesting. Now, what about the way analysts work with this tool? Is it helping or hurting their productivity? It sounds like you're adding something, but you're getting rid of the need for some blacklists and so forth, huh?
Well, really, it is an efficiency tool. So you know, one of our propositions is that this really takes advantage of existing functionality that you have in the network devices and elements that you have in your network. You know, FMS environments already have the ability of ingesting data files to run alerts against. Switches already have the ability of having targeted black or blocking lists and exception lists. Routing tables already have this capability of ingesting different tables to enable the routing mechanisms and logic that they put into the switches. So the idea is we can integrate with these environments. And now what happens is that the fraud management system becomes a much more efficient tool. So first of all, if you're proactively blocking traffic, as we talked about unallocated traffic earlier, you're able to remove that traffic from showing up on the FMS. So now instead of having 1,000 alerts on your queue, you maybe have 250. So now when your fraud analyst can go through the queue, they can actually see some of the other use cases that many times fell below the radar because they just had so much noise in the FMS. Now they're able to focus on those more robust systems like maybe a PBX hacking, a stolen SIM card, or maybe some other types of customer abuse. Now, the second value is that now when you proactively block this traffic, you also have the ability of having that be a catalyst in your FMS to notify your fraud management about tracking this specific customer for potential fraud. So when you have a handset stolen, let's say, and the SIM gets taken and starts pumping revenue share traffic. Well, the first call attempt will be an attempt to call one of those numbers to make sure they can make that call out. Well, Now you can see that, proactively block it. Now you can go forward and say, wait a second, this guy is calling these numbers. Let's start watching that subscriber very closely and see if they had a stolen handset. You know, same concept with the hacked PBX on a Friday afternoon when they start making fraud calls for the weekend. So these are ways you can integrate. So really this gives the fraud manager a lot more flexibility on how to manage their staff and let their staff work on higher value fraud cases than simple things such as a unallocated number range that you shouldn't allow to be dialed anyway.
Yeah, interesting. I feel like this database concept is something that has been missing. You know, frankly, the software vendors are not necessarily talking about it that very much because it's maybe competitive to what they have. But learning about this and also talking to Colin Yates, who's got another database of a different type, it's like there's three prongs in the solution. You got the fraud analyst, who's got to be sharp, and you get the FMS, but also you got this database. And so, and then you've got machine learning kind of coming in. And so it's going to get more complicated, I think, coordinating all those three things as we move forward. So how do you see it shaking out?
Yeah, I definitely agree, Dan. And I think these are all tools in the toolbox that have to be there, right? They all work together. And to your point, really, you know, a solution like TrueNumber Protect is additive to a fraud management system. It's additive to an artificial intelligence analytics environment like we talked about earlier. So the idea is that this is just a way to help the improvement. And as systems and fraud changes over time, you want to manage it on customer satisfaction, managing the margin, looking at the profitability of your routes. Those are the more complex things that fraud systems will have to look into. And then as you expand to other services within the fraud department, all these will integrate together. So I think the idea is putting the right tools in place to leverage your staff to be able to grow into the future as your systems and platforms change and develop.
Wow, okay, this is great perspective, John. Thank you very much. Now, John and I recently talked to each other to create a Black Swan solution guide on this TrueNumber Protect database. And the guide is ready for you to download on the homepage of Black Swan. The title of the guide is The Value of an Authoritative Cloud Database of Global Telephone Numbers in Fraud Blocking and Business Analytics. So thanks again, John, and take care. Hopefully you can get traveling here pretty soon.
You take care too, Dan, and it's a pleasure to talk to you as always. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, I'd now like to welcome Arndt Baranowski, who is CEO of Oculius, a solution provider headquartered in Frankfurt, Germany. Oculius is a relatively small but highly capable company. While they sell fraud control software, they consider fraud protection just one aspect of their mission to serve big carriers, smaller CSPs, SIP providers, wholesalers, and even enterprises with solutions that enable their voice traffic business. Arndt, great to connect with you again. How is your company getting through the coronavirus crisis?
Good morning, Dan. Good. Yeah, everybody's working from home. I mean, actually, no wonder in our industry, I mean, especially with companies like ours, I have people that's distributed over different countries, and therefore for us that was not a major step, and everybody could easily work from home. The other thing is, of course, we're in telco industry. I mean, all new business sort of went into suspense mode, but luckily we are in business for quite some time, and we have existing customers and existing business, allowing us to get through this relatively moderate.
Yeah. Well, Oculius was one of the pioneers in using signaling to intercept traffic pumping fraud, such as international revenue share fraud and WAN-GIRI. Can you explain, Arndt, why signaling interception is so powerful?
The interception of signaling is just simply the core to be, let's say, to get light speed fast. With this interception, we are able to get into time sequences that we can understand within milliseconds what is actually ongoing, and we can get as close as possible to customers which are using telephony, enabling us to really collect the information
when actually calls are going to get kicked off here. And of this, of course, we do pull all the information required for the evaluation for our systems, and that allows us to have information which we would normally collect CDR after a call. We would have this information at call start or even in the first milliseconds of a call. Mm. So this is one critical aspect of the attempt of trying to prevent fraud before it happens.
Yeah, it's great. Excellent. And in recent years, there's been a lot of talk about all of these technologies that add different analytics techniques to the blocking of fraud, such as machine learning, AI, advanced analytics of all types. How is Oculus incorporating the next wave of analytics?
What we've seen so far in the market is that with the introduction of machine learning, certain companies put their focus on machine learning, ignoring what's been already there, and others continued with their existing systems. Actually, existing systems, all these systems which are out on the market, they do use or they do incorporate more or less artificial intelligence, because that's what all automation or that's what all programming is about. What we're focusing on now is having understood what machine learning is about, having understood what of course we do develop, we are actually now looking to combine both technologies in order to achieve the best results. And this way, we don't need to abandon existing technologies, existing achievements, and rather to move only to machine learning. And this way also then it'll be possible to much easier, let's say, configure future systems and allow these systems to operate as wanted.
I see. Interesting. Speaking of innovation, in the last year or so, we published a paper about the great innovation that you folks have done at Oculus regarding stopping enterprise fraud. In countries like Germany and the United States, the enterprise is actually responsible for paying for the cost of a fraud. And to protect those enterprises, you've actually developed a very interesting technology, which I haven't heard anybody else offering, which is to actually intercept the signaling coming right off the PBX switches where most of the fraud comes from.
Yes, this is actually one of our core technologies we've developed over years and incorporated actually in Oculus Protect. Oculus Protect is the name of our customer-centric system, and the principal ideas of that is that we're able to check every call done within 10 to 100 milliseconds and to understand just simply straight away whether that call is authorized and done by the owner of the account or whether that call might have been injected by a fraudster or whether that call might have been the result of a Mongeri attack of a customer or of a legitimate calling person to call back this number. And within these ranges, 10 to 100 milliseconds, we can do these checks on call setup. Customers will not realize it, or calling persons will not realize it. And within this period, we do the check, and we take the decision whether the call can happen. And the decision, of course, here is done by a system which combines AI, which combines machine learning, and several highly intelligent algorithms deciding on whether the call is regular or not.
And one of the unique things about it is it's available, the carriers can offer it to their enterprise customers at a pretty low fee. I think it was something like $60 or something like that per year for a small office. You know, if you get in a call center or a bigger calling operation, it's a little bit more expensive. But in other words, the carrier can actually make money offering it to its customers for their added protection.
Yes, absolutely. The idea here is to do it at a, let's say, no-brainer fee for the customers and allow actually the operator, the service provider who's offering this service, to make some money with that as well. And the idea behind that is just simply, we don't care on how the whole environment is protected. We just simply introduce something like an additional insurance And the fee for the insurance can be in the range of something like between $5 for smaller companies, medium-sized companies, something like $25, large companies, something like around $50 to $100, something like that, per month.
One of the things about it, which is a little bit unusual, is it operates on the Enterprise PBX. It controls the Enterprise EPX, so the telecom will never even see that fraud. You're adding like a double layer of protection. You've got the enterprise doing its protection, but then if that the enterprise doesn't catch it, then you've got all of the carrier systems.
Yes, what's interesting about that is if we look at the communication from the enterprise to the carrier, and even within the carrier network, at any stage we can get into the signaling flow, we can monitor the signaling flow, and as long as we are in ahead of the actual routing happening before, let's say, the call signaling leaves the telco operator, we are able to intercept in real time, and we're able at that stage to prevent fraud happening. That could be even outside or ahead of the telco operator's network, but it could likewise be even within the telco operator's network.
Now, you have an interesting background in your company, Qlius. You came originally serving the wholesale market, and in fact, the first solutions you had were helping wholesalers manage their routing and payment schemes and so forth, the billing. That's an interesting background, and yet you moved into the fraud area, which was a nice move.
Yes, we actually come with a, let's say, operational background, and still this is one of our strong areas. We continue to operate in this area. And from the beginning, the idea was to get something in place which allows to prevent fraud. And from the beginning, we named our solutions anti-fraud systems, like an antivirus system. And we didn't name them like an FMS, like a fraud management system. FMS, to me, much more sounds like a system which then is brought in place in order to manage when the fraud which happened. Our target from the beginning was to fight fraud when it happens, and to have a system which operates and runs as autonomous as possible. And we're in that segment for 8 years now. And yes, our approach is getting more and more acknowledged, and that works quite nicely.
That's great. Well, I just wanted to remind the readers that there's an excellent white paper about the enterprise solution that we've been discussing here on the Black Swan homepage. A lot of discussion about the whole enterprise fraud problem in general. Arn, thank you very much for this briefing and all your continued success, and look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thanks very much, Dan. Looking forward to talking to you soon as well.
Okay, that concludes our discussion with Wayne Geary Experts. If you're interested in the history of the samurai, there are many castles across Japan you can visit. One of the largest and most beautiful is Himeji Castle, located near Osaka. Himeji Castle was first built in the 1300s and then was rebuilt a few times after that. When the general Tokugawa captured the castle in Osaka in the year 1615, he was able to unify the country, which effectively ended the civil wars in Japan for 2.5 centuries. It was at that time that Tokugawa commissioned one of his generals to totally rebuild Himeji Castle from the ground up again. And that's largely the castle we see there today. The samurai thought a lot about building a multi-layer defense. For example, the castle has 3 separate moats, each of them being 22 meters wide. Then along each moat, they built protective walls with holes in them to fire arrows or rifles at the attackers. A second defensive perimeter was on the windows. They built chutes to drop stones on the enemy as they tried to scale the walls. And perhaps the most elaborate of the innovations were the gates of the castle that were designed to disorient the attackers. The entranceways would double around and go the opposite direction. Many of the passageways were made narrow and steep to slow attackers down and make them easy to fire upon. Remember, there were no observation balloons or drones you could deploy to get an aerial view of the castle. The construction details of the castle were kept a mystery. Now, if Tokugawa were alive today, I'd ask him a simple question. Why did you bother to rebuild Himeji Castle? Remember, Tokugawa had just defeated his enemy who occupied Osaka Castle, and he basically won by getting close enough to bombard Osaka Castle with cannons. In other words, Tokugawa's victory essentially proved that castles had outlived their usefulness in the age of artillery. And that leads to my concluding point. Is your fraud control operation spending too much time rebuilding or maintaining old defensive systems that have outlived their usefulness? The future belongs to those who stay on top of the ever-changing threat and constantly rethink their defenses as new innovations and fraud fighting techniques emerge.